Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Our images of fathers and fatherhood are all over the map. The father at the heart of family life, the father who's absent, the father who's a sperm donor, and that's it. But science is paying attention to where and how a father's impact is deepest, by presence, by absence, in life. This hour, On Point, the science of fatherhood. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. How do you see the impact of dad on families? Your family, is dad at the center? Is there no dad in your house? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from New York is Paul Raeburn, author of Do Fathers Matter? What Science is Telling Us About the Parent We've Overlooked. He's a father of five, longtime science editor for the Associated Press, author of the About Fathers blog at Psychology Today, also a regular guest on NPR's Science Friday. You can read an excerpt from his book at our website, onpointradio.org. Paul Raeburn, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Great to be here.
The parent we've overlooked? How can you overlook fathers? They're standing right there, kind of half the equation. What do you mean overlooked?
Well, so here's one little exercise that anybody can try and that I did when I was getting started in the research for the book. If you go to the National Library of Medicine site, it's called PubMed, and you put in mothers or you put in maternal or anything that suggests mothers and search. And I forget the exact numbers. I think I came up with something like 250,000 studies related to mothers. Okay, not more specific than that, just saying mother.
Okay.
If you put father in, you get perhaps 20,000. And any way you do that, maternal, paternal, et cetera, you get about 10 times as many studies devoted to mothers than to fathers. So it's clear just from that crude measure that people haven't looked at fathers nearly as much. And, you know, and I think there are reasons for that. We could talk about that. But the connection between mothers and their children is very clear from the first instant. And the connection between fathers and their children is something we have to hesitate for a moment and think about a little bit. So for some reason that's a little bit mysterious, you know, much, much more work has been done on mothers.
I have to say, as a father myself, very happily a father, I don't hesitate for a second when I think about my connection with my children. It's one of the strongest things ever, anywhere, anytime on my mind. But maybe there is that hesitation there. You write that until recently, when we thought about the roles of fathers in the family, we relied on hunches, instincts, prejudice, and misinformation rather than real understanding. Maybe there is an order of 10 fewer studies being done. Is that being corrected now?
Well, I think a little bit. And I could tell you that another piece of this, yes, I think that many of us knew from the first instant that we were engaged with our children and very happy to be fathers. But the experts were a little slow on that one. Mm-hmm. And, you know, science tends to move in great plodding steps often. Scientists become attached to their hypotheses sometimes more than they should. So through most of the 20th century, one of the predominant theories of child development was what's called the attachment theory. And it came from the British psychologist John Bowlby, who thought that attachment between mothers and their children in the first hours and days and weeks of life was critical for healthy child development. And you notice there's no father in that picture. And so this persisted for a long time. And I have this notion of a moment, you know, in a Starbucks or something, where some psychologist who subscribed to the attachment theory saw a father, you know, feeding his baby or nuzzling it or, you know, just enjoying to the hilt, and might have said, perhaps our theory that excludes fathers is wrong. And, you know, there was a gradual reexamination beginning in the late 70s, which has now taken off. And now there are a lot of reasons to think fathers are essential. But it took something, you know, some change. And for a long time, the experts were, you know, among the last to catch on.
That is the new, then, sort of mini current of research and studies that you, with a lot of experience in sifting through scientific outcomes, studies, have gone out to harvest. Begin to take us into what you found out there. I mean, I think you're probably right. Most people think just on the basis of hunch and instinct and prejudice and maybe misinformation. I think they kind of think they have an intuitive understanding of what it is that fathers do. But you looked at the research, and what do you find there?
Right. I think I shared, I'm not pointing a finger, I think I shared a lot of that misinformation myself before I got into this. So think about pregnancy as one example. Now, most of us would say...
Wait a minute. You're already in ground where I... Okay. I mean, the father is involved, but not pregnant.
Okay, right.
That's we saw Mila Kunis with her rant on one of the late night shows the other night about dads, you think you're pregnant. Don't say we're pregnant. I'm the one who's pregnant, she was
saying. Well, so that's perfect lead up to what I'm about to say, which is that, you know, fathers have a little bit to do with getting that process going, as I think we understand. Mm-hmm. But once it happens, most of us would say that there's not much connection. Father doesn't have much to do. He hangs around for 9 months and waits for the big event. That turns out to be misinformation or myth or something we made up. In fact, when fathers are closely associated with their pregnant partners, they begin to experience a series of really profound biochemical changes. So testosterone, which we often associate with aggression and competition, falls dramatically in fathers when their partners are pregnant.
Really?
Another hormone, prolactin, which rises in women to prepare them for nursing, also rises in men. I didn't even know we had prolactin in our bodies, but
lactin as in milk,
as in milk, exactly, as in milk. That's right. So all these changes happen in fathers. Now, hormonal changes, hormones, our endocrine system is, you know, really primal biology. Mm-hmm. So if those things are being affected, something important is going on. And so there are other connections, too. It turns out that if a father is absent during pregnancy or not engaged with his partner during pregnancy, there's a higher risk that the child will be born prematurely. There's a much higher risk, four times the risk that the child will, four times higher risk of mortality for the child. And so lots of connections both ways. And just one more, if I might, to show that connection.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the fathers, now, when fathers experience depression, we can understand that they might pass on some of the genes responsible for that to their children. But there's a special risk if fathers suffer depression in the prenatal period. Those kids have an even higher risk of depression throughout their lives. Now, the fetus, as it's developing before birth, doesn't know that the father is depressed. But the thinking is that the father's depression affects the mother's behavior in some way that in turn affects the fetus. So the point is, here in a period, we thought this was easy. Fathers aren't too involved during pregnancy. That's wrong. You know, there are lots of things that show that there's a really strong bond between the father and the fetus that he hasn't even met yet.
I'm sitting here with a lot of questions off of that amazing riff. First of all, this fall in testosterone, this rise in prolactin or whatever exactly it was you call it, how much during those 9 months, let's say, does the father have to be around for those hormonal changes to take place? If he's, sent to Afghanistan for 4 months, does it disrupt the whole thing? Does he have to be there every day for 9 months for his body to kind of change in that way, his hormonal balance?
Well, I think we're at early days in this research. So in the early days, you compare fathers who are very involved and fathers who are either not present or not involved at all, and you get these, you know, crude findings. Now, it's now time to refine that a little bit and see, you know, what happens in these gradations of involvement. But clearly, if somebody's deployed overseas for the whole pregnancy, that father is not going to experience these changes. You know, if he's deployed for 4 months, I don't think we know that yet, but we might guess that, you know, the changes would be somewhere in the middle.
And
you know, of the
four
spectrum.
Times the mortality if dad's not around. How's that explained?
Well, a lot of these things are not explained very well. So what I try to do in the book is say, here's what people have found. Here's what the research says. And then you know, and separate that from the speculation about why that's happening. So in the case of the drop in testosterone, you know, the first job, so if we think of males, fathers, human fathers as animals for a bit, which, yep. which we are, mm-hmm. whether even if we like to deny yep. that, the first job that a male has upon maturity is mate seeking. And we compete for mates in human society, men do. And so that requires aggression, competitiveness, all those kinds of things. It's true in the animal kingdom, in primates, monkeys, other closely related and even not so closely related species. So once the father has won a mate in human society, then, you know, it's time to, at some point soon, time to think about reproducing. And a father needs different skills for that. And the thinking is that the fall in testosterone and the rise in prolactin turn this competitive creature into a more nurturing individual and prepare the father for fatherhood, prepare the man for fatherhood. Now, we don't exactly know this is why it happens, but it's plausible that biology would have prepared us for fatherhood because that's the most important thing we do as animals is reproduce.
Paul Rayburn, stand by, if you would. It's so great to have you here. We're talking about the science of fatherhood. We're not even out of pregnancy, and we've got plenty of impacts already. Paul Rayburn's new book is Do Fathers Matter? What Science is Telling Us About the Parent We've Overlooked. Behind us right here, George Strait sings about the unconditional love of a father in his song from 1990, Love Without End, Amen. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
I took my daddy's secret and I passed it on to him. I said, let me tell you a secret about a father's love. A secret that my daddy said was just between us. Said daddies don't just love their children every now and then. It's a love without end, amen. It's a love without end, amen.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the science of fatherhood, how it works, the imprint it leaves, the effect of fathers, with Paul Rayburn, author of the new book, Do Fathers Matter? What Science is Telling Us About the Parent We've Overlooked. Of course, Father's Day coming up this weekend. Everybody's on the bandwagon, at least for a week. Last week, Johnson & Johnson put out a video with real dads talking about why they love being dads.
I don't necessarily want them to be anything in particular. I just want them to be able to be true to themselves about what that is, you know, and I look forward to supporting that.
I love that feeling that I'm giving my three kids this feeling of comfort and security and love. That's what I love about being a dad.
And we've heard about fathers from the President of the United States. This was in February, announcing an initiative to provide support to young men of color. President Obama talking about what it was like for him to grow up, as many Americans do, without a father.
I didn't have a dad in the house. And I was angry about it, even though I didn't necessarily realize it at the time. I made bad choices. I got high without always thinking about the harm that it could do. I didn't always take school as seriously as I should have. I made excuses. Sometimes I sold myself short.
President Obama talking about life without his father as a young man. Paul Rayburn joins us from New York. His new book is Do Fathers Matter? What Science is Telling Us About the Parent We've Overlooked. We've got a lot to look at here with you, Paul, but lots of response already. And here's what Marcia writes to us. Let me just put this to you. Do fathers matter? Sure, but when they're emotionally distant, uninvolved, uncaring little boys in men's bodies who would rather watch a ball game on TV than read with or talk to their own kids, then what good are they to children? She goes on to say the same can be said about bad mothers. It's not a gender thing. One good parent is better than two half-hearted ones, and two good ones are better than one, no matter what their equipment. Interchangeable? What about the roles here and what the studies say, Paul?
Well, fathers and mothers do different things. So I think that's where we start. From on a discussion like this. I think there's a key point there that's exactly right on, and that is it's the quality of the relationship between the father and the child that's important. So I'll step back for 1 minute and say that the single most important thing a father can do for his children is keep them out of poverty. So poverty is the worst thing that can happen to kids. Mm. And a father who earns enough money or helps earn enough money along with a mother to support kids and keep them from that fate is doing something important. I think it's very easy when we talk about some of these things that are on the agenda today to discount the father who may be imperfect in a lot of ways, but who supports the family. That was the traditional model, and that's still important. But beyond that, what fathers can do to help their children develop into healthy and successful individuals is to be engaged with them, and it's the warmth of the relationship. Now, there's an interesting story going back to World War II. There was some concern at the time that many young men were failing their physicals as they were being drafted to serve in the Army. And the question was why that is. And all the experts knew the answer. We're back in the area of misinformation and myth again here. All the experts thought they knew the answer. And the answer was fathers were not exercising strong enough discipline in the home. Fathers needed to be good disciplinarians to raise strong masculine kids. And that was so obvious that nobody really questioned it. It just unfortunately happens to be wrong. And as father research began to take off and people went back to look at that, it turns out that the way to, you know, have your sons develop into strong, independent individuals is not to hammer them with discipline, but to have a very warm relationship with them. Because if you have that relationship, they will want to be like dad. And that's how they mature and grow up to be able to handle the many things fathers have to do, including the sometimes, extreme case of going to war. So, again, you know, another one of those cases where all the experts thought they knew the answer and it was wrong.
Take us on beyond instinct and hunch to what studies find about specific impacts, imprints left by fathers in particular. I'm curious to know what science pulls out here.
Well, if we move on from pregnancy to the early years of a child's life, one of the things I've always enjoyed as a father is watching my kids learn to talk, which is very exciting, and you can almost see new words appearing daily. You've been through that too.
So. Yes.
And so you might think that because in many families, mothers still spend more time with the kids, that mothers have a lot to do with that language development. So a researcher named Lynn Vernon Fagans at the University of North Carolina decided to look at this. And what she found was that, in fact, it was the fathers who had the predominant influence.
Why?
So the first thing is that there were, you know, families that were more educated and had better child care, those kids did better with language development. But the role of fathers is thought to be that because fathers spend less time with their children in many families, because they're a little bit less attuned to their children's language ability at the ages of 1.5 and 2 and 2.5, they use more vocabulary. They don't stop to think to attune their language to the child as much. And that pulls the kids along. So the kids hear more words, they begin to learn them sooner and develop their language more rapidly. Now, that's a good thing all by itself. But even better, the bonus is that if they do well at language development, they're going to make an easier transition to school. They're going to do better in elementary school in terms of their school performance, fewer behavioral problems. They're going to continue to do better in school, and there's even some association with social competence and ease as adults. So, you know, talking to your kids and spending time with them, if you're a father, has all kinds of benefits that can last a lifetime.
Especially when you're bringing in vocabulary that they may not already be comfortable with. You write at some length about play and father play versus mother play and the roughhousing piece in particular, the sort of rowdy play. What about it?
Well, play turns out to be another one of those things that's a lifelong importance. Now, I think one of the few pieces of father research that most of us know and most of our listeners will know is that fathers play differently from mothers. So this was actually discovered in a series of studies in the late 1970s as father research began. And so fathers, I mean,
it's another
are
one of those people
likely
may roll their eyes and say, you needed a study to learn that? Just look at, you know, who's that crazy guy wrestling down on the living room floor? But okay.
Yeah, exactly. I'm not here to defend the sometimes odd choices the scientists
That's
make.
Fine.
I'm
That's
just
good.
Here to tell you what they found out.
So what they learned.
So what they learned was that this kind of open-ended play, the roughhousing, you know, less likelihood to play games, more likelihood to just create, make up things, increases kids' social competence. It and particularly if fathers, there's actually a lesson in here. I learned something from this. If there's give and take, so if fathers dictate the play all the time, that's less good than if they let the kids make suggestions. And so that the kids are listened to and their decisions are respected, that even might mean letting them cheat at chutes and ladders now and then or whatever it is. And so that they develop, you know, again, a kind of social ease. They know that what they say will be respected and they have that easy relationship. And that's sometimes described as a bridge to the outside world. So as children mature and spend less time with their families and more time at school and college and other adult tasks, play in the early years can help prepare them for that and make that a better transition.
The kind of casual give-and-take play. You write about fathers and daughters and how their involvement with daughters can lead to a reduced risk of early puberty. How?
Well, this is another one of these mysterious things that I found fascinating. So when a father is absent or, you know, barely present and not engaged with his teenage daughters, those teenage daughters will go into puberty at an earlier age.
And we've seen a lot of that among young American females.
We see a lot of that. In fact, there was a story that made national news a few years ago that I mentioned in Do Fathers Matter about Fraser High School. I believe it was in Tennessee. And there was a real crisis. It made national news because something like one in four or one in five girls in the high school were pregnant or had been pregnant. You know, it was this huge scandal. And a lot of the local officials said, well, this is because of all those shows on MTV about teenage mothers. And, you know, it's our pop culture that's affecting the kids. And some researchers looked at that and said, wait a minute, let's look at these families. And it turned out that in those families, about one in four had an absent father. So the idea was that it was the absence of the father, not the pop culture symbols, that led to that crisis at that high school. So we don't know why a father's absence will put a girl into puberty sooner. It may be pheromones, his scent, so to speak.
You quote Bruce Ellis at the University of Arizona saying that it may be the pheromones slowing down puberty development.
That's right. And again, you know, development of puberty is one of those primal biological transitions. And that fathers can affect that just by being there or not is amazing. The problem with the early puberty is that's also linked to more higher risk of risky sexual behavior, higher likelihood, as with that high school in Tennessee, of teenage pregnancy. And, you know, it just can put a daughters on a bad road. So this is one of those things that until somebody looked, I don't think we had any idea this connection was there. And it's just one of many things that I write about that show these connections between fathers and children.
Kate in West Hartford, Connecticut. Hi, Kate. You're on the air. What's your experience, Kate?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
Yes.
Our experience has been one that has really surprised both my husband and I. The relationship between my husband and our son, our 22-month-old son, is really profound. Paul, you were talking about the quality of the time a father spends, and I wholeheartedly agree with that. The time that he gets to spend with his dad is extraordinarily important, and I really do fade in the background as soon as he comes home. They have had a strong bond, really, since Eli was born, from the very first hours when my husband would sing to him. It's really has surprised us, and mainly for my husband, because he really did not have a lot of strong paternal modeling. So he really wasn't sure. We were both really hesitant to have a child. We weren't sure if this was going to come naturally, but indeed it did. It came extremely naturally for him, and the relationship that they have is really strong. And again, he gets to spend evenings with him and morning time and weekends. And that is just, it really carries over. And I think Eli is thriving because of that important bond that they have.
Kate, we hear you celebrating that just in the way you describe it. And I'm glad it's working out so well. That's a beautiful thing when it does. It's terrific. Let us pick it up. I appreciate your call. Paul, I mean, that sounds like a mom who's very happy with her husband, father's engagement right there, and well, very laudatory about it.
Yeah, clearly he's been reading and studying the research because he's doing the right thing. So,
does it come naturally to everyone? They were worried whether it would be there or not because of his own family history. Is that a legitimate concern?
You know, that's not something – I didn't find research addressing that particular concern. But it's certainly true that – I know from just talking to dads and dads groups and so forth that many, many men, young men starting families will say, I want to be a better father than my father was. So that's clearly a widespread feeling. And one of the things that's interesting, to go back to the caller for a minute, the some of the studies have shown that even at as young as 2 or 3 months, when a baby is 2 or 3 months old, if the parents walk into the room, the baby will often reach for the father. And the reason is because even at that early age, babies have learned that mother is more likely to change the diaper and clean up the baby and take care of chores, while father is more likely to bounce the baby up in the air or on his knee and have fun. And so kids pick that up pretty quickly. I don't want any mothers to be offended by this. And every time I say this, my wife says, I play with the kids too, you know. So
sure she does. I can just see the eyes rolling all over
yeah,
the world.
Exactly.
Oh, great. Oh, great.
Exactly.
Yet again, you know, change the diapers right. And the other parent gets all the fun.
Exactly.
of course, both can do both. Kevin in Black Creek, New York. Kevin, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was raised in the 80s and 90s by an older stay-at-home dad, and I went on to be an officer in the Army and transitioned from being a captain to being a stay-at-home dad myself.
Uh-huh.
And it's one of the things I've seen early on, you were talking about almost being overlooked, is that when I would take my son when he was growing up to playgrounds or play dates at the parks with other kids his age, most of the mothers around would look around for my son's mom and would overlook the fact that I was even there playing with him, actively engaged with him. And when they would realize that I was the one there with him, you'd see this look come over their face, almost like pity for my son. Like, oh,
right, where's the mom? Poor kid stuck with the dad. Do you think that's changed? Exactly. Has that passed, Kevin?
It took time. The more that we engaged with the playgroups and the other moms, it's almost like I've been an adopted mom now with some of the groups. You know, they've seen that I do know what I'm doing. They are confident, you know, and they've welcomed me in, and the looks have stopped finally.
Social changes all around. Captain Kevin on the playground with his child. We've got a comment online here. Kevin, thanks for your call. Paul, here's AC writes, guilty of misandry. I used to suspiciously double-check when I saw a man alone with children. There was Kevin getting some of that kind of hairy eyeball at the playground or pity for his son.
Well, you know, I saw a horrible story on Facebook just a few weeks ago of a father who was with, I think it was a 3-month-old child, and I'm not sure about the age of the child, but the father was in a playground with the child, and somebody in the playground called the police because there was this guy there with a kid. And the father was detained for 20 minutes while he was searched and his ID was checked and everything else. And to say that he was offended by that would be a king-size understatement. So these things can happen. You know, attitudes change slowly. And the research can show us which directions we ought to be going in. But the rest of us, it takes time for us to get there.
Kevin mentioned being raised by an older father. You've looked at a lot of research there about a kind of biological clock for men, implications of older fatherhood. We'll look at that and much more. Paul Rayburn is with us. His new book is Do Fathers Matter? What Science is Telling Us About the Parent We've Overlooked. Will Smith with Just the Two of Us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Why you do that? I try to be a tough dad, but you be making me laugh. Crazy joy when I see the eyes of my baby boy. I pledge to you, I will always do everything I can. Show you how to be a man. Dignity, integrity, honor, and I don't mind if you lose, long as you came with it. And you can cry, ain't no shame in it. It didn't work out with me and your mom, but yo, push come to shove, you was conceived in love. So if the world attacks and you slide off track, remember one fact, I got your back.
Just the two of us, we can make it if we try.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the science of fatherhood, how it works, the imprint it leaves, the effect of fathers. Paul Rayburn is my guest. His new book is Do Fathers Matter? What Science is Telling Us About the Parent We've Overlooked. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. All kinds of father figures out there. Here from the ABC sitcom Modern Family, three different families, four dads. One of those, Phil Dunphy, played by Ty Burrell.
I'm the cool dad. That's my thing. I'm hip. I surf the web. I text. LOL. Laugh out loud. OMG. Oh my God. WTF. Why the face? You know, I know all the dances to High School Musical, so.
Okay, there's the cool dad. Here from fatherhood.gov, a public service announcement, pro wrestler Roman Reigns, pro wrestler, has a tea party with his daughter.
Here is my handle and here is my spell.
When I get all steamed up, then I shout.
Tip me over and pour me out. Oh!
The smallest moments can have the biggest impact on a child's life.
Cheers.
I'm loving these. And here, one more from that same website, a commercial where a father practices a cheer, as in cheerleading, with his daughter.
We got the spirit. We're hot. We can't be stopped. We got the spirit. We're hot. We can't be stopped. We're going to beat them and bust them.
The smallest moments can have the biggest impact on a child's life.
A little bit rowdy. R-O-W-D-Y.
Take time to be a dad today.
Paul Rayburn, those ads are out there because they feel a need to encourage fatherhood, as if it doesn't have, you know, the obvious support or engagement that it ought to have. What do you see?
Yeah, so the question is, back to the question we started with, why fathers seem to be overlooked and so forth, and you know, I think that's changing. This research that's been done over the last two or three decades is starting to have some effect. But most of these researchers talk to each other. You know, not much. I mean, it was an opportunity for me to do a book because not a lot of this has made it into the press so far. Mm. And that's a problem. You know, we still need to get the word out on these things. One of the things I talk about in the book, I don't talk a lot about divorce, other than, you know, some of these things associated with father's absence. But, you know, as we begin to learn how important fathers are in the lives of their children, we would hope that family court judges would take that into account when they make decisions. And these are people under a lot of pressure making decisions in very complicated situations. But to give a father, you know, one weekend a month or two weekends a month and feel like that's enough, the research is clearly saying that's not enough. And, you know, some people talk about shared parenting, and all these things are so freighted with political implications, and women's groups have some ideas about them, and some fathers' groups have some other ideas. It's tough to sort out, but we need to make informed decisions about fathers and kids. And until we, you know, but one of the reasons I wrote the book was, if we're going to have that conversation about fathers and kids, let's, you know, collect what we know about fathers and kids, get rid of those myths, and then have a better discussion because we know what the facts are.
Val in Boston. Val, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just had to call in because to pay tribute to my 82-year-old dad, and I'm not sure if this is exactly on point, but it's a long-term view. The more I go on in life, I realize how much his story of surviving World War II and being orphaned at the age of 11 has impacted me and my own loss and difficult times.
Even when he's 82 and you're presumably not a kid, Val.
Yeah, so in my childhood, it was my mom who did a lot more of the day-to-day child rearing. They were both working in the 70s, but she had a modified work schedule and he worked long hours. However, the fact that he got through his difficult childhood, was a refugee, immigrated to the States in the 50s, and then went through the last many, many years with a joyful spirit. He's a lifelong learner, and now he's taking care of my mom's mom in her old age with Alzheimer's without any self-pity, was probably the strongest human influence in my life when I lost my husband to cancer 4 years ago.
Does it matter that he's a father, or just then that he's a, as you say, a joyful, strong model, whatever the gender, Val?
I think that's a great question, and that's why I wasn't sure if I should call in or not. Just, I think it's just entitled to talk around.
I mean, no disrespect at all in that question.
I don't know. I mean, I think I appreciate the speaker's point earlier about the impact of financial provision. I guess the same could be questioned about that. Is it, does it matter the gender the parent provides money? so that the kids aren't poor. So I guess in the same spirit, I would say the fact that my dad provided a role model for me has been a really strong anchor point for me. And again, you know, hands up in the air in terms of whether it would matter strongly enough if it was my mom.
Val, respect heard and received and honored. It's wonderful that you've got that kind of father, and I appreciate your call. Let me get one more. Marie in West Palm Beach, Florida. Marie, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Yes, I wanted to say I am a single parent. My son is grown now.
Yeah.
But it was very clear to me, I was an older mother, and realized early on, my son was two, and he wanted to know where his father was. I didn't think that would even come up till he was five.
Mm-hmm.
But he went happily along, aware of the fact that most of the other kids' dads were there to pick him up at daycare. He didn't have that, but he developed fine. I believe that in my experience, what mothers bring is the home, the nest, the nurturing, the support, the love, the day-to-day, kiss those boo-boos. However, what fathers bring is validation, security. They're a bridge to this is how a man, male, acts in the outside world. This is the model you can use to define your life as a young man. In my son's case, he came well-balanced. So I was fortunate in that degree. He had the opportunity to meet his father when he was in junior high school. I arranged it, and it wasn't like he was pushing for it. But nevertheless, what that allowed him was to see, oh, this is how I'm very much like my father.
I'm sure that meeting was important even then, but this is not a situation in which dad was around for much at all of your child's upbringing. Marie, I appreciate that story and what you raised right there. Forgive me, but let me take it to Paul while we have time here. Paul, what about single motherhood? There's a lot of it in this country now. And the way that Marie is thinking about what the impact of that could be, what mothers bring, what fathers bring, let's start with when there's only a mother who's really doing the parenting job.
Well, this is one thing I wanted to think about a lot. I didn't want to suggest that single mothers were doing anything wrong by any means. In fact, I can think of two examples of people raised by single mothers who did reasonably well in their careers, and that would be Bill Clinton and Barack Obama, managed to squeeze by.
And not to mention these days when it's not just single mothers, but households with two moms.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. Well, that's another show. We could talk more about that, too. That's right. And two dads.
Mm-hmm.
But one key thing does come out of the research for single mothers, and that is that if it's possible, it's smart for them to find a father figure for their children. If they have a brother who's nearby or a cousin or another family member, a neighbor, a close friend, that a father figure can supply some of the things that a father would supply and can be helpful, not to mention somebody to watch the kids once in a while when you go out for groceries.
Let me go to Bob in Columbia, South Carolina, on this front. Bob, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hello, Bob. You're on. Thanks for calling. What's your story?
Well, my story is that I grew up in a family, basically from second grade on, without a father. And even though I was farmed out in summer times and I had uncles, it wasn't the same. And even though growing up I had a blank credit card to go to friends' house to do things, sports things, and so forth, with that family, and there was a father there, it wasn't the same. And so I do work in this organization called Family Honor, which is centered here in Columbia, South Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
And in one of the programs, I have a contribution that talks about the absent father and the effects of an absent father. But we put it in a positive light. And the idea is that the best parents are two parents, a father and a mother, because we can do things, the same thing, but we do them differently, the complementarity of the father and the mother. And so what I talk about is that for young men growing up in a family without a father, what happens is there's less trouble getting in trouble with the legal system. There's less tendency to go on drugs or other destructive behaviors or whatever. There's less of a tendency to be involved sexually. And there's generally, some of the data shows that there's even a lower IQ. Now, I have my PhD in physics, so would that mean that it would have been easier for me to complete that degree? I don't know. But what happens with women when there's a father around? What happens is they receive warmth, love, and affection, so they don't go seeking it elsewhere. There's less of a tendency for them to become sexually active and to seek affection from a male figure outside the family.
Bob, let me take that perspective to Paul with me right here. I mean, people build great matrices of their own insights, and clearly Bob's invested right there, Paul. In your research, what about this issue of complementarity, male and female?
Well, I do point out a lot of what we've talked about through the hour has been things that are unique contributions of fathers or much more often made by fathers. So there are differences. I don't think there's any question about that. The research shows that. And, you know, the point about friends and relatives and father figures not being quite the same speaks exactly to the point that fathers do matter to their kids. I think in terms of while the complementarity is nice, there is, you know, a growing body of research that shows that in gay families, lesbian families and gay families, that those kids do just fine. And I didn't write about this too much in the book, but in talking to some of those families, what happens there is that they tend to invent their own roles in the families more so than the rest of us.
Kind of divisions of labor or...
That's right. I mean, the rest of us... Yes, I mean, we you know, in a family with a father and a mother, we tend to step into roles that have been established for us to a certain extent. We can buck those a bit, but it's sitting there waiting for us. With gay families and lesbian families, they don't have that. So I think many of them are excited about the idea of, you know, forging their own way and forging a new way. And probably we all have a lot to learn from those families.
Stephen's calling from North Kingston, Rhode Island, Kingstown. Stephen, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I have a different spin on it in the sense that I'm a single father and effectively have the kids all the time. And I wanted to know, my kids are under 10. I have a daughter and a son, and I just wanted to know what the research shows for long-term effect of being raised by just a father. And, you know, at the moment, there's not a strong female in their life.
Stephen, we'll try. I don't know if we have that answer, but it's a significant population. I'm looking here at a U.S. Census Bureau release saying 17% of single parents in this country are men. Paul, can you tell us anything about that front?
Well, Tom, I think you got it right. We don't know too much about that. And the reason is, although there's a growing number of single fathers, and that will probably increase, that's a relatively recent phenomenon. And we just we haven't had time yet to look at that too closely. I'm sure that's on the mind. There are probably experiments going on right now looking at that. But it's not something that I ran across in my research.
Stephen, we wish you good luck with it. Let's talk about older fathers for a second. Women often hear about the biological clock, but your survey of the research finds a lot of reason for men to think about a biological clock as well.
There's no question men have a biological clock, too. And having, you know, the children of older fathers, so we're talking 40s, 50s, children of those fathers have an increased risk of autism, increased risk of schizophrenia, increased risk of, you know, certain behavioral disorders, some odd and unusual genetic ailments, a whole series of things, and Down syndrome as well. Many of us know that older women have an increased risk of having children with Down syndrome. And it turns out, you know, for men in their 40s, the risk is about the same. Now, you might ask, why don't we know this? Why haven't we heard this before? And this is starting to get around in the news and become a little bit more widely known. But it's just something that obstetricians and genetic counselors haven't focused on. Now, somebody wrote something about the book the other day and said, well, maybe men ought to go out and get their sperm frozen when they're younger because of this risk. Most of the people I talked to didn't think the risk was enough alone to for men to decide whether or not to have children. In other words, if you're a man is 45 or 50 and is thinking about having a child, there are many, many things that go into that decision, and it's probably not right to say, I'm too old, it's too risky, I shouldn't do it. Some men may decide that, but my argument on this thing is that we ought to know about this. This is something older men should know about before they decide to have kids so they can make an informed decision.
Can they have personalized risk assessment? You mentioned genetic counseling. Beyond the sort of gross numbers, can they look at their own genetic profile at that age and determine what their personal risk is?
No, they can't, because we don't know exactly how this happens. So the thinking is that it's a problem in what are called spermatogonia, which are the sperm factories in men's bodies. And those tend to wear out a bit through age, just the way a woman's eggs will wear out. So we don't know exactly enough about that to be able to look for it. So it's just a generalized risk for older men at this point.
Well, from speech to play to the biological clock for older men, you've told us and taught us a lot in this hour. We're grateful for it, Paul. The new book is Do Fathers Matter? What Science is Telling Us About the Parent We've Overlooked. We had a hunch that we knew everything, and maybe we didn't, Paul. Maybe you're right on that front.
Doesn't life tell us that all the time about all kinds of things?
It sure does. Fathers, mothers, you name it. Paul Rayburn, thank you so much for being with us this hour. It's just been a delight talking with you. And you've got five kids. Happy Father's Day coming up, Paul.
Yeah, same to you, Tom. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you so much. Listeners, thanks for all of your comments, questions, calls. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.